Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Double Cross Radio. I'm Chuck Horton, and I'm going to be joined tonight by my co-host David Kirk-West and frequent guest and contributor Greg Askins, and we have a great show lined up for you. We are not going to be able to have Drew Lamb tonight because he is battling the elements trying to recover the roof on his kind of warehouse farm, which the high winds in the valley today kind of of it. So he's trying to effect repairs there, or at least get it temporarily patched, and won't be able to be with us tonight. Drew, you're listening to this. We're missing you, guys. So hope everything worked out okay. So David, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, Chuck. Thanks for having me on. Kind of short notice, I know.
Yeah. And Greg, it's always a pleasure to hear what you have to add, and you have some great information for us a little later on. We're going to start off with David here. You got to see the movie that a lot of people are talking about, American Sniper. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to waste my money on it or not, but now that I have a review, I can decide yes or no for sure based on your review. So the pressure is on. What'd you think of the movie?
Well, so I have a lot of thoughts on this movie. There's sort of the side of me that watches it purely as a filmmaker and a movie fan, and there's also the side that's analyzing, you know, the message of it from a libertarian perspective. As a film, the movie has been getting quite a bit of praise. The critical reviews were solid, not amazing, but solid. But the response from people has been overwhelmingly positive. Like, people are loving it. They're treating this like almost like a religious experience. I find it kind of gross because, as a filmmaker, you know, and a film fan and someone who's pretty good at being objective, I could watch the biggest propaganda film in the world. And while I might hate the message, I could say, yeah, as a movie, that was good or not. And American Sniper is really just okay. That's about it. It's okay. It's not amazing. It's far from the best war movie ever made. It's not the worst war movie ever made. It's not even the worst like propaganda film ever made about the modern day war on terror. That honor would probably go to 2012's Act of Valor, which is also about Navy SEALs and was god awful from both an artistic and libertarian standpoint. American Sniper, Bradley Cooper gives a good performance. It's relatively well directed. I thought the pacing was a little weird at times. There was some really outlandishly cheesy stuff with with his sniper school training when he was a kid. And then the cheesiest thing of all was there's a scene, it's become pretty infamous on the internet at this point, where Chris Kyle and his wife are having this incredibly tense conversation about whether or not he should go back to Iraq or he should stay with his family and get out of the military. And I was just about to start busting up laughing because Bradley Cooper is holding this baby that is so obviously fake and so obviously rubber that it's legitimately distracting from the scene. You can actually even see his thumb like wiggling the arm at one point. So from a movie standpoint, it's kind of a typical Clint Eastwood directed film. I like Clint Eastwood a lot as an actor, and I like a lot of the films he's directed too, but they always have this sort of rough quality to them because Clint Eastwood, for whatever reason, is a fan of not doing very many takes. He thinks you always get your freshest material in the first, two or three takes. So I've always felt like Clint Eastwood movies feel a little bit rough around the edges. I guess he likes it. He thinks it's naturalistic or something. I personally prefer more stylized movies, from perfectionist auteur directors like David Fincher, Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, anyone like that. I like that kind of more refined aesthetic, where David Fincher will do 100 takes to get the right thing. So that's on the movie side. As a movie, it's okay. It's really nothing special. I wouldn't feel like you're, being left out of anything amazing if you don't see it in theaters. But if you do decide to see it in theaters, just as a movie, you'll have an okay time. As a, you know, it's being accused of being a propaganda film. And on that front, it's actually a lot more interesting in that it wasn't quite the rah-rah, go America propaganda film that I kind of expected it to be. But I think that most of the American public is too dumb to realize that. And so ultimately, I think it's actually kind of bad that it wasn't, for a couple of reasons. So the movie, you know, you would if you've read Chris Kyle's book, and I haven't read it, but I've started listening to the audiobook recently, and I've read many articles and many other excerpts from it. So at some point, I will have finished it. We might have to discuss that book then. But he was a braggart and a cold-blooded killer, and he would, you know, he considered Iraqis savages, and he says some really horrifying, blatantly racist, disgusting things in his book. And if the movie had been an accurate portrayal of him as a person, it would have either been a character study about a sociopath, or it would have tried to portray it as some kind of, you know, jingoistic war porn fantasy. And the movie didn't really do either of those things. What it did was it humanized Chris Kyle a lot and made him a much more sympathetic character, which works better for a film, but is not at all accurate to who he was. They make Bradley Cooper seem like a pretty decent person. They make him seem, you know, more empathetic. They make him be a little more thoughtful. You know, they show him having a lot of regret about killing people. And there's some really inaccurate things in the movie. Like he's, you know, he goes to talk to an army, well, not army, a military psychologist or whatever, for some counseling. And the counselor says, "Would it surprise you if the Navy, if I told you the Navy has credited you with 160 confirmed kills?" And that whole scene's ridiculous because, for one thing, the Navy doesn't actually like track kills and keep a, you know, a kill count in your personnel file. And for another thing, they were trying to play it off as he didn't even realize how many people he'd killed until he was told, which is flat out not true. Cause in his book, he talks about how, yeah, they say I have 160 confirmed kills, but by my count, it's 255, which is probably bullshit, as anyone who's paid attention to how much Chris Kyle lied can know.
Yeah. As well, we're speaking of the lies, this is probably the most that I know about this whole story is the defamation suit that was brought by Jesse Ventura against Chris Kyle. And it dragged on for so long that Chris Kyle actually died before that trial came to conclusion. But Jesse Ventura won his trial, and he gets profits from the book until he feels that his name has been restored or whatever.
Yeah, the judge awarded him like $1.8 million in damages. And actually, that's a funny case because all the super patriotic warmongers were hating on Jesse Ventura. And all the legal analysts before the trial said there's no way Ventura is going to win. The jury is going to be too sympathetic to the quote-unquote war hero Chris Kyle. They're going to be too sympathetic to his widow, who Jesse Ventura was quote-unquote suing. He wasn't really suing the widow. He was suing the Kyle estate at that point. And actually, all of the damages would end up, or all or most of the damages would end up being covered by the publisher's insurance that they have specifically for such a situation, you know, to protect them from lawsuits. So the idea that Jesse Ventura was somehow like going to be making a widow and orphans go broke was ridiculous. And not just because the money wasn't going to come from them, even if it was, between the book, the movie, and you know, all the outpouring of support and stuff that came since Chris Kyle's been killed, then all the other things he did. I mean, if that family doesn't have a net worth approaching $10 million, I would be shocked. So they're not hurting for money.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that
I thought it was kind of strange in that trial, the defense, I guess it would be the defense for Chris Kyle's, the attorneys for Chris Kyle's estate, mm-hmm. couldn't find one witness that would testify to any of the facts that were in the book.
Yeah, no, they couldn't. They beforehand, he claimed he had tons of witnesses, and I think they did end up, I could be wrong, but I think they did end up getting one, you know, quote, witness,
yeah, who wouldn't
who gave them a very different story, yeah. Or, you know, a conflicting story. And then Chris Kyle, gave throughout various interviews and a taped deposition that was played at the trial, a deposition that had been recorded on video sometime before he was killed. And he gave like a conflicting story there. And basically, he had everything in his favor up until it actually came to the trial. And he had no witnesses, and his deposition didn't make a lot of sense, and they saw conflicting stories. And Jesse Ventura had, you know, multiple witnesses who said, yeah, he was never even there that night. I don't know what they're talking about. So he had tons of corroboration for his story, and he ended up winning, contrary to what all the legal analysts thought. Basically, he won a case that people thought was unwinnable, which only, in my opinion, lends more credence to it. But that's not even the most blatant of Chris Kyle's lies, because to some extent, that's one of those situations where there will always be the warmongers who will try to say, oh, you know, the court was in Jesse Ventura's favor because he used to be governor, or some nonsense like that. And there's just not enough witnesses either way to really prove anything. Chris Kyle's other lies are more egregious. The two big ones that everybody knows are, he claimed that in 2005 during Hurricane Katrina, he was deployed to New Orleans, and from atop the Superdome racked up 30 kills on looters, which is, one, indicative of a horrible human being who is either a full-on, who either committed full-on serial killings in the United States at the behest of the government, or someone who has fantasies about doing it. And, you know, like, which one of those is better? And of course, there was absolutely zero evidence of this. There was no, it just never happened. Never happened. There's zero evidence for it. Tons of evidence contrary. And even his like commanding officer, when asked about it by some, you know, investigative journalist, what did he say? He said, yeah, that story defies the imagination. Even people who knew Kyle were saying that wasn't true. The other big story he made up was that he claimed that right after he got back from a deployment in 2009, he shot two men trying to carjack him, and killed them, and then waited for the cops to show up. And when the cops showed up, he told. And of course, the story portrays him as quite the badass. You know, he sized them up, and he could tell, you know, this guy was more confident with the guns, so I'm going to shoot him first. And then he said, "I got to reach into my truck and grab the keys." And you know, when he did that, he grabbed his gun and shot underneath his arm behind him and shot one guy in the chest and spun around and shot the other. I mean, he told it many times, and it got quite elaborate. And then he said he leaned up against his truck and waited for the police to come. And when the police arrived, supposedly they talked to him, and he gave him a phone number, and they called it, and they wouldn't say. He's given multiple accounts. Like in some versions, he said he wouldn't say where the phone number went to, but kind of insinuated it was a Pentagon. In other stories, the cops ran his details, and a number popped up on their computer screen for the Pentagon, and they called it, and they said, "Oh, this man's a war hero. Leave him alone." And so he added that part to the story, presumably to try to cover up the fact there's no evidence for it, because supposedly the cops wanted to keep it hush hush, didn't want to give him the trouble. They went inside and reviewed the footage of the shooting, and we're like, oh yeah, it's justified. So let him go, and nothing ever came of it. And and he claims that since then he's gotten emails from cops around the country thanking him for cleaning up the streets. And of course, when that claim got widespread, it ended up being investigated by many journalists, and they found that there were no gas stations in Texas that knew of the event. There was no records of two people being killed in any manner that even remotely matched it. No cops came forward. You know, it just, again, didn't happen. And the other really big lie, and one that has possibly the most absolute undeniable evidence of all that Chris Kyle made, was he claimed that he was going to be donating all the proceeds of his book, American Sniper, to the families of fallen warriors and to wounded warriors and whatnot. And that was even a claim that got trumpeted around a lot when Jesse Ventura first pursued his lawsuit. Everybody said, how horrible that you would sue this man's family after he's dead, and they're giving away all the proceeds to charity. It ended up coming out in the court documents. And, you know, this would have been about, I don't know, 8 months ago, last June, I think, when this happened. It came out around that time that the book had generated something like $3.2 million in revenue. I'm sure with the movie, that's skyrocketed at this point. But it had generated something like $3.2 million in revenue. And the Kyles had only donated $56,000, which, I mean, you know, it's their right not to donate their money. But when they say they're going to donate it all and then they donate, I mean, what does that amount to? Like 3% of it or something?
I think it's
might be less. Oh, I think it's like about 1.5%. Yeah, it's not much. It's a very, very small.
I think it's about, yeah, 1.5 is about right, about a little less than 1.5.
Yeah, I think it is about 1.5 now I think about it. Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. And her excuse was that, oh, well, according to tax laws, you can only donate $13,000 a year or something. And it's like, yeah, okay, whatever you say, that's ridiculous. There's the lies. Back to the movie, though. The interesting thing about it is
according to tax laws, you can only donate that and take it off your taxes, but if you could still donate the whole thing, if that's what
exactly, you can still donate it.
I think you'd have to pay taxes on, so you'd have to save out enough to pay the taxes, but you can donate the profits that are left after taxes, the entire amount for
I don't know how that works. I am assuming you must be able to write off more than that. I think that what she was actually referring to is, I think you can only gift that to somebody.
Well, it's a percentage. Taxed. You can go up to a limit, up to a percentage of your income, up to a certain amount, or a percentage of your taxes or something. I'm not a tax lawyer, so I'm probably wrong, but yeah.
It's funny.
He's just a total despicable person.
a lot of the times I make fun of, you know, the social justice warriors who talk about trigger words and, you know, rape culture and all that stuff. But I've realized now that it's tax season that I do have a trigger word, and it's taxes. I get livid and can hardly handle myself when I start hearing about taxes.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the movie. I'll wrap this up here real quick. But the interesting thing about it was that it actually tried to have a somewhat thoughtful portrayal of war. It showed a man who was conflicted, which wasn't the real Chris Kyle. It, you know, tried to show some of the negative impacts war has on people. And, a lot of people have tried to say it has an anti-war message. I think that's wishful thinking. Even Clint Eastwood said that it makes a strong anti-war message. The reason that I think he's completely wrong about that is that the only anti-war message the movie makes is that war is bad for America's soldiers, which is one anti-war argument. Yes. You know, I think it's hard to argue that war is not bad for soldiers when we have something like 22 of them committing suicide every day, veterans and active duty military. And, but so the movie tries to show, yes, that war is bad for American soldiers. It tries to show some of the negative effects it can have on someone's personal life. And it does show war is ugly, but it never shows, maybe these Iraqis were justified. You know, Chris Kyle just calls them savages, says, I've never seen evil like that. And he never, you know, later in the movie comes to the realization, oh, that woman and her child, her, you know, 8-10-year-old child who were throwing grenades at us, that wasn't evil. That was desperation. He never comes to a realization like that. It never, ever humanizes Iraqis. They're basically shown as either complete savages or, cowardly collaborators with the U.S. military, and so for that reason,
yeah. Probably to be fair, there's probably a few of them that fit that mold, but the majority of them are just trying to do whatever they can to survive.
And so for that reason, the message doesn't come off as anti-war. It comes off as we should do more to treat our troops well when they come home. And the worst part of all of it is that whatever little tiny scrap of anti-war sentiment there is in the movie is completely lost on the retarded American population. I mean, it just flies right over their heads. So that's kind of my review of the movie. Of course, as I'm sure you've seen by now, I made a little imaginary trailer for a theoretical Team America 2 a sequel to the Team America movie, that I used clips from American Sniper, Lone Survivor, Act of Valor, all these sort of hyper-patriotic, neoconservative propaganda films that have come out the last few years. And I made fun of it in the context of saying it's basically like America, like Team America. And it's pretty funny. So if you guys want to check that out, you can see that on the Double Crossed page.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave. That was a pretty good review, actually. I was using all my willpower to keep from interrupting more than I did. That's great. Okay, so we're going to move on. We're going to move on to Greg Askins. He's joining us to talk about some health issues brought on by the, I guess we call it the rising tide of glyphosate in our food supply, both in our food and our water. And so, Greg, welcome back to the show. And Hello. And let's get started on this. Let's start as though you're talking to people that know nothing about glyphosate and explain what it is.
Well, most people have encountered it before. You know, they've seen it in the home improvement store or at their local nursery where it's Roundup. You know, Roundup is glyphosate. And it started in the 70s. This thing's been going on for a long time. They used to talk about it as being a salt. Like, oh, it's just salt. It's not going to harm you. It's just salt.
Yeah, and I remember the people telling me the first time I came across it, they told me this is because it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. It completely breaks down when it hits the soil. So if the plant doesn't absorb it, it hits the soil, it breaks apart to its components and they're harmless.
Right. But what are the components? Right. I mean, any basic chemist is going to say, well, what is the chemistry? What are we talking about? Is it salt? No, it's not really salt. It's a potassium and it's a phosphate. And the phosphate is the dangerous part in my estimation here because of the straight up fact that it's inorganic phosphate and it bioaccumulates in the soil. And so there's evidence that, and even in their own tests, it shows that this binds to soil in a way that it prevents the normal transmission of potassium. And this is a vital ingredient, a vital nutrient for plants and for people. And so you'll see a whole range of effects that are basically signs of potassium deficiency. You know, it's not like really a real toxin in the typical sense.
One that people might encounter would be cramps.
Correct. Yeah, I mean it's essential. It's in the same way that calcium, magnesium are essential for the normal operation of the body. In this case, the one unique thing in glyphosate is that it disrupts the synthesis of aromatic amino acids, and those are kind of unique. There's only a couple of them: tyrosine, tryptophan, and phenylalanine are the most common. These are, you might have heard of them before. These are kind of important for the normal synthesis of energy. That's tyrosine. Tryptophan is essential for serotonin, so people who are having sleep problems. And phenylalanine. And phenylalanine, primarily in the people who don't have a toxic allergy to phenylalanine, there's like 2% of the population that are actually, you know, just normally allergic to phenylalanine. But in the case of people who need it, this is 98% of us, phenylalanine is used for pain management. So in my just like quick overview, even in the early days when this thing was coming out, when I first heard about it was probably in the early 90s. And I did some investigation and found that those amino acids are essential for energy and for sleep and for pain.
Don't they also have something to do with the production of vitamin D, and which also is helps?
I think amino acids, are building blocks for everything else in our body. So
yeah,
there's protein chain, and that's how it breaks the plants down. I mean, plants die when they put this salt on the plant because of it interfering with its natural production of you know, enzymes and its normal defenses against nature primarily. And so it's just dying at a slow rate. And this idea that it's not bioaccumulative or it just degrades rapidly is not proven, even on their own research.
This makes a lot of sense because the main energy transmitter in plants is, of course, is cholesterol is in the animals chlorophyll, and cholesterol and chlorophyll are very similar in structure. So it probably by destroying the chlorophyll, it destroys the energy that the plant's going to get, so it withers and dies.
Correct. In the case of broadleaves, now they're putting this on soybeans. Now soybean has an oil, so there's a different chain. There's a whole different type of material that's being derived that has a whole different basis that's, you know, independent of chlorophyll and cellulose. Oils are inside the cells, and when they take the soybean, for instance, and they modify it, every cell in that soybean now is producing Roundup. It is actually exuding glyphosate out of every cell. And the purpose of that is to interrupt its natural pests, right? But so... Yeah. The concept that it is eliminated by washing it off or by time is insane, because that's not happening anymore. Now it has gotten to the point where it is genetically engineered into the plant, in the case of potatoes, sweet potatoes specifically, sorry, and corn, and in the case of soybeans, we're talking about where the plant can generate its own glyphosate from the interior structure of every cell of the plant. And in through their own toxicity studies, it proves that it is sturdy, right? It does not break down in the case of extreme cold or extreme heat. So when they store it, so let's say in the case of right now where they're in the case of 2,4-D, this is the ultimate level of this glyphosate. They've come to a really radical, extreme level that they used to use in Vietnam as an herbicide. And we all realize that Agent Orange was dangerous because of what it was doing to people. Now 2,4-D has been approved by the EPA, and that is the essential building block. It's not the entire thing, but it's basically everything that's in Agent Orange. It's the toxic parts. Now they've run into a couple of problems here. So now they've engineered the plant. They have the patent that was established in the 70s has run out. So now there's over 2,000 products manufactured outside the patent. They range all over the place. Some people put a huge amount in. Some people use other adjunctants. There's a whole bunch of, let's say conspiracy. I would say it's a lot of, it's hard to find out because a lot of this stuff is secret because it's trademarked. It's patented. It's corporate secrets. So you're really not able to find out what the enzymes are, what the actual manufacturers use to make their products. But
yeah, it's so bad, it's even impossible for anybody to test it because that's considered a copyright or a patent violation.
Correct. Yeah, it would be one of those DMCA 2000 violations to actually take it to a lab and try to deconstruct their product to find out what they use to make it.
Or even just test it on animals.
Well, exactly. Anything that would prove what they've done to manufacture it or what it does, all that stuff is now illegal. And it's basically in between the whistleblower lawsuits and this whole clamping down from the government side, it makes it impossible to really question the information you're getting. And the fact is that the safety tests, the fact that everything that the government is basing this product safety on is provided by the manufacturer of that company, of that product. You have to really wonder if there isn't a financial incentive. I mean, it's basically common sense that there should be a check and balance against this. There should be a common sense where the EPA has a incentive to deconstruct the product and understand what its base level, what is it doing, how does it work, what is the dangers when it exposes other products. I mean, like right now, the issue that most people don't know about and farmers are keenly aware of is the fact that genetic transmission is occurring through, you know, in a very rapid way, in like between one and two generations, this gene that allows a plant to survive Roundup or glyphosate is passed on to the plants that they are trying to spray. These are things like purslane and, you know, really kind of benign weeds that people are worried about that, you know, they're robbing water and food. I understand the necessity to take them away, but I think they need to work at a better balance. So here's the issue. Now this purslane has inherited a new genetic trait within a matter of one or two generations from a laboratory that took 10 generations to establish and to prove the effectiveness of this gene. Well, now it's already into the crop that they're trying to eliminate. So now, no matter how much pesticide they'll use, it's never going to be effective. In fact, it's probably starting to feed the pest crops, the basic, you know, it's dandelions, it's basic things that live on the surface that people consider weeds. I consider them medicine, all of them. I mean, that's the other part of it, but I won't even get into that. So the point is, none of this is working. This is all a scam from the top down, from the manufacturer who's convinced the FDA that this is the right course of action, that the USDA has bought into it, that this is the best trade-off between using more pesticides and between using... well, I guess straight up more labor. I mean, that's the way I look at it. This is a trade-off of labor. If we used more hands-on agricultural techniques and we pulled weeds ourselves, we would not need these chemicals. There would be no need for them. And we wouldn't. But they've interrupted the whole process through patents and through trademarks and through force. Through some front companies, if you've watched the documentary Food Incorporated and read the book, it talks about how they've strong-armed the farmers by basically buying up the seed harvesting equipment, right? So all the
yeah.
So they've taken away the ability for them to, you know, regenerate their own crops in a normal process. Now, with patents, it's expected that you go back to the manufacturer every year to buy your seed. And that's how they're started to shift the culture into their favor, where you're buying more seed back from the manufacturer every single year, reharvest none of your own seed, and now you're locked into it because they have owned all of the... manufacturing, you know, all the seed sorting tools. Anyway,
yeah, now this is really devious on a lot of fronts. There's this isn't just the United States. The things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a quote unquote free trade agreement, we know right away that it's a lie because you don't need any kind of treaty for free trade. It's free trade doesn't require agreements and treaties. It's just people trade.
Right.
So yeah, you know right away it's like one of those double speak treaty names. Yeah. But they're using that to force countries to accept these GMO crops and the Roundup ready crops, and so they can use Roundup, because to not accept those into their nations is a trade violation, then they'll be subject to all sorts of penalties. And so they're going to strong arm them using the force of the World Government Trade Organization, yeah, or something, to force these countries, which have really healthy food coming out of them, to adopt these practices we use in the United States, which I think are producing really horrible food that are leading to a lot of these 900 chronic diseases that are rising at astronomical rates. Including but not limited to type 2 diabetes, hypertension,
fibromyalgia,
lupus,
Crohn's.
They're just, yeah, Crohn's.
celiac.
Leaky gut, celiac. Yeah. It just the list goes on. There's over 900 chronic diseases that are tied to our food supply. They aren't all caused by glyphosates and GMO crops, but at the minimum, these things are at least a contributing factor to some of these. They don't make things better or help your body heal. They actually put it in a more stressful situation. So,
correct.
It's just to do this with the whole world means it's almost like they're trying to wipe out most of the population or something.
If they're not trying to, they're just straight ignorant. I mean, there could be an excuse where
I don't think someone that could bioengineer these crops is ignorant.
I agree. I agree. You can't claim
I'm not going to give them that.
No, I was going there. I'm just saying you can't claim ignorance if you're an engineer. Like, you can't simultaneously say, I know everything, but I didn't know that. Like, it doesn't work. I know. But the point is that my emphasis always is follow the money. And so on three or four different fronts, there's just pure profit. I mean, there's no way to consider this issue without considering who profits from this in every regard.
The poor farmer, he's left with this choice. If I refuse to use this product, then I'm a trade violator. I'll be attacked by the trade organization.
They've been
convinced. And if I do, then I'm a slave to that patent, and I'll never be able to escape from that. I'll be like my neighbor down the road that loses money every year, and he's finally going to lose his farm.
Right.
And then that farm is then bought by a large corporation. And
that's sort of an anecdotal, like a 10-year-old, maybe 20-year-old thought even. Because at this point, literally, if you live in the bread belt and you buy your seed, it's from one company. There's only one seed for sale. I mean, it's not a choice issue. It's a straight up, this is what you can get. This is what's for sale.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to buy a ton of organic corn seed. There's nobody providing it. That's the problem.
I'm going to point out that Greg is very knowledgeable in these things, and I know not as much as he does, but I know what I know. And neither one of us are biologists or scientists, but right. This is not rocket science either.
No, I'm a hobbyist. Sorry.
Yeah. The information that's there, for instance, the way they harvest grain crops today, they put in Roundup resistant seeds, and they grow with the weeds, and they don't care if the weeds are growing with them. They spray the crops about a week or two before they harvest them.
Right.
The weeds are not resistant; they wither and die theoretically. But as you said, that a lot of them are resistant to the Roundup now too. And then when they harvest it, these plants have taken up some of this glyphosate into them. So now the grains that people are eating are full of glyphosate, and this plays havoc with their digestive system. So it's killing the beneficial bacteria they have in their digestive system, and they're not getting all the nutrition out of the food they're eating, and especially things that they might even become irritated and swollen and not absorbing much of anything. But they're losing out on minerals.
Correct.
They're losing out on all sorts of essential nutrients that aren't going to be absorbed up into their body to replace things.
Yeah,
so
right.
They start having like aging diseases well before they should have them.
Right.
People are getting cancer at younger and younger and younger ages and in greater number at younger ages. And I think it's because of our, this is one of the contributing factors. It's not just one thing, but.
Right, right. No, I think this is becoming to be more prevalent in our atmosphere and in our, especially in our valley specifically, because of it being such a small bowl. You know, we're more subject to these sort of things than, say, somebody in Iowa, where maybe they're putting out thousands and pounds of this stuff, millions of pounds, but it's being spread at a wider range. You know, maybe they're not being as affected. But the point is, it's a giant experiment. You know, they tested this on rats in a very isolated way. They tested it on fish. They tested it on quite a few different types of animals. And what I've read in the evidence, it sort of is actually the opposite of what they've said of the conclusion. The evidence is that in fish specifically, a very small amount, like 5 grams, in an entire pond of goldfish produced a genetic alteration in those fish, right? So it is causing specifically the ends of the genetic chain to become damaged. And we know that this is, right, the telomeres specifically are related to problems like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. This is that, like, shortening of your age, that you're going to have more and more problems and more mutations, more of your cells are malfunctioning because, you know, it's like tearing apart your DNA. Radiation does this, you know, it's very unusual. So at a very, very low level, fish are affected. We know people are very closely related to fish. I mean, this is absurd that we're only using the rats and the mice basically for the baseline, and that the levels that they were serving them, and for a very short period of time. In a lot of the studies I read, it said that too many of the test subjects died from toxicity, right? So they were unable to determine the level, the safe level of toxicity. But they just sort of extrapolated it and went, well, we just assume this is safe in people. And sort of went over the top of what the actual evidence shows. And so, you know, even if you're not questioning the money, you have to still take to common sense and look at the evidence and say, well, how did they come to these conclusions? Who was responsible for signing off for this stuff? In this case, they were responsible themselves. You know, specifically Monsanto told the government, hey, we have proven it's perfectly safe. Well, no, they haven't. Actually, if you read their own studies, it's not safe at all.
I think Monsanto had acquired the company that produced aspartame, and they're using the same playbook that company used to get that approved. Is they hire labs to prove that it's safe until they find one that says that, and then they use that. They throw away the ones that say it isn't safe, and when they finally get one to corroborate what they're trying to say, then they use that when they submit it for approval.
Right. It's just cherry picking. I mean, if you spend enough time doing enough studies and you spend enough money, you'll get the study you want. And I think that's
the Donald Rumsfeld theory.
Right. And these guys really stink of being involved with the same folks. It's a very similar case to aspartame in the fact that it was discovered by accident for a completely different purpose, and that the engineer who had come up with it had no clue that it could have any commercial aspect to it, so he just shelved it. And so it was only later, it was like 7 or 8 years later after the original discovery, that someone else discovered, this guy named John France, discovered that it could have a weed-killing aspect to it, that they decided to start using it. And so in the 70s, it was just sprayed, and it was fairly benign. It washed off, and it, you know, it was no big deal. It basically survived in the environment for probably between 8 and maybe, you know, on the hard case, I'd guess a month. But, you know, as I was a kid, I grew up in this valley with Harry and David Orchards. There's a pear growing company that grew orchards all around residential areas right around my house. Like, literally, they were in my backyard. So 10 feet outside of my backyard was an orchard. And when I went to elementary school for 6 years, I was surrounded on two sides by orchards.
So I know which elementary school you went to. I think David... Yeah. I think he lives in that district now.
Yeah, it was right down there on Garfield. And so that right at that point, before the golf course, which has gone in there now, before then there was orchards surrounding two sides of the elementary school. What's important about that is that's the side where we had the playground. And so at that point we had become familiar with the crop duster. It was a gentleman who had one arm. He was probably a World War II vet, had lost an arm in the war and become a, sort of a well-known crop duster in the valley. He was kind of the one or two guys that sprayed herbicides from the air onto these orchards. And we knew he had one arm, and it was kind of a well-known thing. And so the kids used to, myself included, would wave at him to encourage him to wave at us back. And so I was that close. Like, literally, this is like a barnstormer. You know, he's not biplane. He's literally like a low single wing, you know, under the fuselage type of.
Yeah, they have to get down close so they get more of it.
He's coming around like 100 feet under, you know, he's really, really low. And so we're making like eye-to-eye contact with him as a group of children, waving at him, and he would wave back at us. And that's when we realized, you know, he's flying the plane with his knees, and that he would flip the switch to hit the pesticide release ahead of time so he could wave at us. But that would mean that we all got sprayed. And, you know, at that time, it was just expected that was all perfectly safe. Everybody was told, it's just salt. It's just salt. It's wonderful. You'll love it. It's not going to hurt you. It doesn't hurt people.
And yeah, I think I remember somebody doing a thing where they actually drank a glass of it
I'm sure they did. When I used to work at PBS, there was a video that I had from the Historical Society. Right in the 1960s, they had done a DDT demonstration, except for it was in the middle of the Pear Blossom Parade. And at that time, they were driving a truck through the middle of the town on the Pear Blossom Parade with thousands of children and people waving and stuff. And they just gassed everyone. And the side of the truck said, DDT is fine. Like, it was like literally promoting how great DDT was. And it was a very short period of time before we realized that was a horrible idea. But and so this is sort of the lesson that in hindsight, history generally determines that these things were really bad ideas. We're going into a really deep spiral here where we're using more and more and more of this pesticide that we don't understand how it fundamentally works and how it affects people. We're making giant leaps and bounds and assumptions about how it works, I should say.
Yeah.
It's not that we don't know. It's that we're making giant assumptions that are probably generally false about how it works. And that's, I think, the danger, is that these are affecting millions and millions and millions of people and the general, I mean, like the mass food supply of everyone. Like 90% of people are being exposed to this. They do not realize it because it's not directly being sprayed on them, but it's being sprayed on every single piece of food that they're eating, or it's being exuded out of the cells of every single food that they're eating, and they don't have any idea.
Yeah, and there's I'll just give some examples here. 50 years ago, Alzheimer's was virtually unknown.
Right.
It was so rare a disease that people just it. And I'm young enough to have been alive 50 years ago, and I'd never heard of it until I was maybe in college, and maybe it was after college when it started. People started to, oh, he's got Alzheimer's, whatever. And then President Reagan ended up with Alzheimer's. And, you know, all of a sudden we have people in their 40s now are coming down with Alzheimer's. And some people say, well, it just was misdiagnosed before as senility and this. And that. It wasn't. There's about five different kinds of brain diseases that are possible. Some of them are reversible by just changing your diet, but Alzheimer's is pretty unique, and the specific tests you do to confirm it it shows that it definitely is that. And it seems like it's something has changed in this country that has led to this. You know, I don't know if it's a deficiency disease. It's not something that's contagious or anything. So it has to be something that it's lacking in our food supply, or something's preventing the absorption of an essential nutrient or group of nutrients. And this is one place I think people should be looking. They should be, but they can't test it because it would violate copyright patents and intellectual property laws.
Or
and,
in the case that you don't even know. I mean, this is the issue about the whole non-GMO labeling, right? They don't want to have to disclose the information because then you could put one and two together. At this point, you eat corn, you don't know how much Roundup's in it. How much does it naturally produce in its own D-alpha glyphosate form? How much of it is being sprayed on the surface? You know that the EPA regulates it and the USDA has signed off on the amount that they're spraying, but how much is that? Like, do you have any idea?
I have an idea.
It's a lot. It's
worldwide
seems to be
worldwide. Let's see if I can find this quote again.
Now it's the new thing is the combination of D-alpha glyphosate, which is the type which is genetically engineered into the plant, and the sprayed on Roundup. Like they have to combine the.
This is just the sprayed on amount. I have this quote. This is Dr. Permuter. I think I said that right. It's probably not right. He wrote a book called Grain, the Brain Grain or the Grain Brain. Grain Brain, yeah. I think it's called.
Grain Brain.
Yeah. Awesome book. It's about how grains kind of destroy our mental processes a little bit. He said that globally is estimated that by 2017, farmers will apply 1.35 million metric tons. A ton is 2,000 pounds.
2,000 pounds, yeah.
That's a lot of glyphosate on to just be applied on their crops. Plus, you have to add in the glyphosate that's being produced by the plants that have been bred to produce their own.
Correct.
It's just got to be a much larger amount than this.
It is actually 95% of soy, sweet.
Yes.
Sweet beets.
So all you vegetarians out there think you're getting your protein from tofu, you better rethink that one. Better be going organic.
Quinoa and spirulina. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this is just a horrible thing. There are some things people can do. It's not going to be complete protection. But first of all, you better really find out where your bread's coming from. Because a lot of glyphosate poisoning in your digestive tract is being misdiagnosed as glucose intolerance.
Right. Or a grain problem.
Gluten intolerance. IBS. Not glucose, gluten.
Right. Is IBS, fructose malabsorption. This is a new one.
Yeah.
It's being prescribed or
diagnosed.
You know, diagnosed with, right. Yep.
Yeah. And so there's, you have to watch out what you eat. I would say that I would try as much as you can afford it. I would try to stay in organic realm, but there's some foods that are going to be more problematic than others. So soy, corn, and sweet potatoes are probably the worst. Generally fruits that have a skin like oranges or lemons and limes, those are fairly safe, but things like apples,
papayas,
not so much.
Yeah, papayas have been genetically engineered 5 or 6 years ago, so they've managed to capture a big chunk of the market. There's a large range of products that just have this herbicide applied to it because of the type of farming techniques that we're using. So, I mean, honestly, it's a systemic problem. This goes down, you know, way beyond top down. This has to do with factory farms. This has to do with mechanized farms. There's a whole different way of growing food that doesn't require any of these problems. And, you know, none of these problems would occur if you just naturally went back to the way food was supposed to be grown. You picked out the weeds. You naturally, you know, went around a couple of days, a week, and picked them out of the ground. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's kind of dangerous. One thing that we didn't touch on was the fact that the way the tests were done, of course, was pretty self-serving. You know, we talked about cherry picking, that they would likely pick the best results for their profit. But the other thing
there's a really horrible incentive there. The companies know that they're going to be passed over next time if they don't give them the result they're looking for. So they're trying to make the buck too. And so their profit incentive is to skew the results so it looks favorable.
Well, and of course, the board had been convinced that genetically engineering these crops to produce their own pesticide was the best way to deliver pesticide to the plant, because then they're not spraying it, because farmers complained about overspray. Right now, what they have to do is they have to put really fine amounts of spray onto the crop that they don't want to grow, right next to a crop they do want to grow. And they could be inches away from each other. So it takes a lot of precision. Well, they don't want to do that level of work. They just want to spray the whole damn acreage, and just whatever is not supposed to be there dies. And of course, what that ends up doing is killing the soil. There's a whole problem about how this product was tested in a sort of virgin environment, right? So imagine 10 years ago, they discover this product, they test it in the environment, one sort of things happen. 10 years later, a whole different sort of situation is happening now because of the fact that the understructure of the soil has been decomposed. That basically many of the amino acids, the enzymes, the little microzia, all these different fungus that are responsible for breaking down all these different parts of the soil have been killed. And so now the soil no longer functions in the same way. So basically we've got toxic soil, we've got toxic plants.
It's dead and toxic.
None of this stuff is helping anybody. None of this is food anymore. People have to get away from this, and they have to get back to the old ways. It's going to take a little more labor, but guess what? We have a lot of labor force.
I have a anecdotal story, and it's totally anecdotal. It doesn't prove anything, but I traveled to Ecuador for 2 weeks and to Playa del Carmen for 1 week. And in both in Ecuador and in Mexico, they largely use farming methods that are been around forever. We use them in this country up until about mid 20th century. And eating the food there, I had so much more energy. Both my wife and I felt better than we had felt in a long time. And we really didn't want to leave the second time because we knew that coming back here was going to be harder to find food of that quality. And we weren't paying more for that food. We were paying less for that food.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
It's
supply and demand. You know, we used to be a major producer, this whole country. We had a majority of farmers and we had a majority of farmland. And, you know, now we have Megacorp, Mega Farm. And in a few hands, we've controlled all of the food and all of the, you know, chemicals and all the byproducts of those foods.
I'm not going to try and land real hard on the corporations. So I imagine some of them have long-range visions. But really what the people who run those things are, they get stock options and things like that. Their incentive is to make as much money in the short term as possible to make the value of their stock more so they can cash in on that. They're given the stock option at a lower cost and whatever.
Hey, we all want to make money.
Yeah. Hey, limit. I hear the music. Our time has run out. Thank you, everybody, for listening. See you next week. We're gonna diss on Lincoln next week.
I have a corporation.
Okay, we'll see you all later. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks.